to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Tom Beal. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Susan. Let's begin with the weather. Compliments of the National Weather Service, weather.gov. Today, we should have a high about 26 degrees. Our wind chill factor may be as low as zero, however. South-southwest wind, 5 to 19 miles per hour, becoming calm in the afternoon. A chance of precipitation, 90%. New snow accumulation of less than an inch possible. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy, with a low around 18. Wind chill factor as low as 5. Light and variable wind becoming south-southwest, 8 to 13 miles per hour in the evening. Winds could gust as high as 21 miles per hour. Thursday, partly sunny with a high near 38. Wind chill factor as low as 10. South-southwest wind, 8 to 14 miles per hour, becoming west in the afternoon. Winds could gust as high as 23 miles per hour. Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 18. Wind west 7 to 13 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour.
This is KHOI Radio. And Tom Beal and I, Susan Franzen, are your hosts. Most of our program today will deal with the Squaw Creek Watershed Authority and its plans. And the hour will end with a report from Kay Puttock on the community organization we are focusing on this month, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI. To get started, I'd like to make a special mention of the phenology calendar that we have been talking about in recent weeks. As Pat Schlarbaum tells us, phenology is the record of the events that mark the natural year. So far, we've had chickadees, screech owls, and coyotes beginning their mating calls, as well as deer losing their antlers, at least according to the calendar, which contains the records of the nature watchers from the Raccoon River watershed.
Well, we've been assuming that there wouldn't be a big difference between the dates of natural events in the Raccoon River watershed, which is near Des Moines, and the Squaw Creek watershed, which is someplace around Ames. But I certainly couldn't have told you where. Water doesn't seem very important to people around here. But in Washington State, where I grew up, the watersheds are very important, and there are strict laws governing how those areas are regulated. And much is being done to ensure the purity of the water, especially in western Washington.
I never thought much about the watershed either until last week when I heard about a meeting in Nevada of the Squaw Creek Management Authority. It sounded like something that affects not only the people in Ames, but through much of our listening area. When I saw the map of the Squaw Creek watershed, I knew that it was something that affects us all more than we know. And I have been fortunate to find great guests to introduce it.
So who are these guests? Tell us about them.
Well, first, we have Jerry Keyes from the Story County Conservation Center, who's here representing Iowa Water today. We're happy to welcome you back as our live guest, Jerry.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And thanks for coming out on this miserable, miserable day.
Yeah, but it's more snow to ski in.
Well, Jerry, I think we'd like to have you first tell us a little bit about Iowa Water. What is it and what does it do?
Sure. Simply put, the Iowa Water Program is a citizens volunteer water monitoring program. The Iowa Water Program trains citizens to conduct basic water chemical, physical, and biological measurements, basically looking at the invertebrates that are in that water. They provide you the training and all the equipment and tools you need to start understanding and protecting Iowa's valuable water resources.
So, well, we'll hear more about that later. Now, our second guest is Pat Conrad of EOR, Water Ecology Community, who is on the phone from his office in Oakdale, Minnesota. Are you with us, Pat?
I am.
Well, thank you for accepting our call.
Yeah, you bet, yeah. Well, joining you guys this morning.
We are looking forward to talking with you two together, maybe in a little dialogue. But first, I need to introduce our third guest, who's only with us on recording because she has family responsibilities at the time of our live broadcast. This is Penny Brown Huber, and she's telling us why watersheds are something important to us. Can you put her on?
How do you know
where your watershed is.
So that's always a puzzling problem for lots of folks. You know, part of it is how we orient ourselves within our own boundaries. So often, you know, obviously we all know what county we live in. We'll often know, you know, we obviously know what city or township we live in. You you might even, if you're a rural resident, you know, you might know another location. But we don't talk often about watersheds. And one of the folks on our board actually had made the suggestion last year that our soil and water districts tend to be county bound. But wouldn't it be more interesting if our soil and water districts were watershed bound? And, you know, with Squaw Creek watershed, about 1.3 million acres, really all of the folks that live and work within the Squaw Creek watershed have something in common, which is water, right? We need to be concerned about the water quality, the water quantity. Obviously, we want to have the river be good for recreational purposes, the wildlife that exists because of the watershed. But finding those watershed boundaries can be quite challenging. And part of our project is sort of to inform and engage the public in the Squaw Creek watershed so that they become more aware, you know, of where they live within the watershed and what they're doing that might impact the watershed, and then also what we want to do as a group of citizens to improve the watershed. And so it is a different way of thinking about where we live. I think what's really interesting, about 2 years ago, the state, the legislature, decided that they were going to try and create watershed management authorities. And they actually wrote some rules so watershed management authorities could be created in Iowa. And Minnesota, if you go up to Minnesota, you'll see they have very very detailed watershed management authorities. And so we're just embarking on this in Iowa. This is kind of a new idea. And so the Squaw Creek watershed now has a management authority established. And they're beginning to look at creating this plan that we might be able to implement then over 5-10 years. It's going to be a plan that we hope people who live within the watershed will put a voice to, and it will be developed in a way that everybody has a chance to participate, and we're going to be thinking through how can we improve the water quality, the water quantity, which we know sometimes we have a lot of rain, either too much rain or too little rain, and then improving the stream so that we can recreate on it, go canoeing, go kayaking, fishing, and then improving really the wildlife's habitat, you know, so that the ducks, the geese, the fish, you know, all of the wonderful critters along a stream.
For those who are interested in seeing a map of the Squaw Creek watershed, there is a link on our website under Read More. As Penny says, it extends north into Webster County and includes a good portion of Boone County as well as much of Story County, although the map is under the Story County when you Google. There's a more detailed report of the meeting of the Squaw Creek Watershed Authority that I mentioned last week.
I'm eager to hear what Jerry and Pat have to say. Where shall we begin?
Well, we don't really yet have a definition of watershed, and I'm sure that Pat would be the person to ask about that. So, Pat?
I'll take a stab at that. Essentially, the term watershed is simply used to describe all the land that drains to a common point. I think it's easiest to picture when you think in terms of like a lake. So in the case of a lake, there's a very defined watershed area, and it's topographically all the area that drains down into that lake. Where it gets a little bit more confusing, a little bit more complicated, is when we use the term to refer to the watershed of a creek or a river. In this case, you know, it's all kind of based on the scale of the area that you're looking at. So in the case of the Squaw Creek watershed, it's the area that you just described, but it ends at the point at which the Squaw Creek drains down into the Upper Skunk River. So then we can expand that and look at, well, what's the watershed of the Upper Squaw of the Upper Skunk River? Well, that becomes a larger area, and then that flows down into the Mississippi River. Then we can expand that even further and look at the watershed of the Mississippi River, and then we can take that all the way up to almost a national scale where we look at what is the watershed of the entire Gulf of Mexico. So basically you can think of it as a hierarchy of ever-increasing areas. So if we take this illustration again and start down at the Gulf of Mexico, you know, virtually the entire central portion of the United States drains down into the Gulf of Mexico, so that's its watershed. And then as we go back upstream, we have the Upper Mississippi River watershed, and then we can take that down to the Skunk River and then the Squaw Creek. And then even within the Squaw Creek, we can define watersheds to the various tributary streams that feed into that creek. So I think it's kind of a hierarchy. And I think if you look at it that way, it's kind of, that's how you can understand what a watershed is.
Well, thank you. Actually, as you were talking, I was reminded of a description that Penny gave me yesterday. We were talking about flooding in our area, which we're all very aware of. And she said, well, it's a big problem for Ames because we're like the bottom of the bowl. And all the water runs down to that junction you were mentioning between the Squaw and the Skunk River. And so we get it in two ways and then pass it on down to Des Moines. But what are the other factors that affect water quality as well as flooding?
Sure. The big thing with when we talk in terms of watersheds is, you know, the quality of the resources, the rivers and streams and lakes, are really a reflection of that watershed and the health of that watershed. So you can think of it in terms of this draining but also washing off of the land surfaces. So when we have very urban areas, we've got a lot of impervious surfaces, our roads, our houses, our parking lots, and all the contaminants that build up on those surfaces, after a rainfall, they wash down into the stream. Also, with those impervious surfaces, we're preventing a lot of that natural rainfall from soaking into the ground, and so we get an increase in the volume of water that comes off of those surfaces. When we look in agricultural areas, similar issues exist in that we haven't made those surfaces impervious, but what we've done is we've made them incredibly connected to our water resources. So we've built ditches and we've installed drain tile that quickly route that water down to our streams, carrying the sediment and nutrients and pollutants that wash off of those agricultural fields. So those are kind of the primary factors that, you know, are concerned with watersheds and their effect on our water resources.
Well, I guess that the purpose of the ongoing work that you're going to be doing with us down here in Iowa is what can be done to address these factors after we understand what they are here.
Correct. You know, I think it's important to understand kind of the setting of watershed management, too, in that largely in this country, we've gone through and we've addressed what are considered point sources of pollution. So, you know, think of it in terms of the pipe that coming out of a, you know, an industrial site or a wastewater treatment facility. We've got controls on those types of pollution. What we have looked at for the last 30, 40 years now is what we term non-point source pollution. So that's the things that build up on the surfaces of our watershed and wash down into the stream. So that's kind of the reason why we're looking at these sources of pollution. So in terms of what can be done, you know, again, you have to look at the different types of of land uses. And I think a critical component of this is that, you know, everyone within the watershed can play a role in improving water quality and flooding issues. It's not just the large agricultural tracts. It's not just the large holdings of residential land, but everybody from a residential homeowner doing certain things to those large landholders can all do a little something. And really what it amounts to is a very simple philosophy of trying to keep the raindrop as close to where it lands as possible. So instead of flushing off the land and routing water down to our streams, we want to try to hold that raindrop and hold that runoff on site. So in the case of agricultural areas, we're always looking for opportunities to either manage drain tile water, to improve soil health, to look at opportunities to withhold that water within the soil profile, use of cover crops and, you know, minimal tillage practices are also kind of ideas for trying to hold that water up in the soil rather than washing it down. In residential areas, in the more urban areas, we look at minimizing and limiting and reducing and eliminating the amount of impervious surfaces. So in the case of a new development, we may have more narrow roads. We might have smaller parking lots. We also look for opportunities to take that water and soak it into the ground at a very, very small scale. So within, you know, maybe between two homes, a small rain garden, rather than pick up all our drainage water into the street, into the curb and gutter, down into that storm sewer and rush it off down to the stream, we want to hold it back and soak it into people's yards with rain gardens and those types of practices.
Could I ask briefly, Pat, what a rain garden is?
Sure. A rain garden is simply, a slight depression in the landscape that we use to hold water. Think of it as in terms of, traditionally in more residential areas, we've got the curb on the street where we take that water and we get it down into the ground, into pipes. Rather than do that, we'd almost go to like that old fashioned, swale kind of thing next to the road, but in very limited areas where we know what the infiltration capacity of those soils is, so we know that the water is going to soak into those areas. Many times in all cases, they're vegetated with native plants, so you have a nice-looking little feature in the yard, and it can be a very small feature, size of a car, basically. But what it's designed to do is hold those very small storm events. So very small rains will fill this up, and then it's designed to drain down in a very short time, so we don't have standing water and issues like that. But we have just a nice little feature that helps us get rid of those small storms.
And also, it's good irrigation. I have one that I won't go. I'm so proud of it. I put it in before I knew what a rain garden was to take care of runoff from a sump pump.
Okay. Sure.
Well, I'm doing my part. I have a leaky basement, so I'm retaining water that way.
You've got a little storm sewer, storm pond in your basement, huh?
I do.
But
well, that brings up another interesting issue in some areas within urban areas where we have drain tile and we have flooding issues in basements where we're running pumps and those types of things. It's really important not to route that water down onto our driveways and into the street and down to the stream. We really do kind of want to hold that water back up into the yard and try to soak that water in rather than flush that down into the streams.
Right.
Well, mentioning the streams, one of the things that I know from Penny is that we're very fortunate here that we have, for many years, thanks to Isle Water, been doing good monitoring in this watershed. I think I'll take just a couple of minutes to play what she had to play, and then we can turn to Jerry for the real deal.
I just think Iowans are so capable. This is not a topic or a subject that we cannot tackle. We can. we are very capable of coming up with new ideas and ways to work together to solve problems. We are almost, often I think we're almost uniquely suited for that in the nation. I mean, if you think about sometimes the problems we tackle together. So I totally think we can tackle improving our watershed and creating clean water and reducing the quantity of water and having beautiful recreational spots and you know, having a wildlife habitat that is extraordinary. I mean, we can do this. This is not beyond what we can do. I mean, I think we're really remarkable people. So, and the thing great about it is, I think if, like, people are always welcome to come to our meetings. And, like, Pat from EOR will be presenting every meeting more data and more interesting facts. And people are so welcome to come to those and learn a little bit. You know, we're trying to find solutions. We're not trying to craft issues. We're trying just to find solutions. And it's not reasonable to think everything's going to change overnight. It's going to take time. But I always marvel at how Iowans can, when they put their mind to it, they can solve anything. And you can just, it's just about will and then finding the way. That's all it is.
Well, we're now going to be talking to someone who's part of a group that has been finding the will to find out what our issues are, what our problems are that we need solutions for. So, Jerry?
Yeah, sure. One thing I want to mention is the whole water testing concept is not something new. There have been groups like the Isaac Walton League Save Our Stream program that has been doing water quality testing for decades. It was the Iowa Environmental Council that put a grassroots coalition together in 1996. To develop a statewide volunteer monitoring program. It actually got off the ground in 1999 was the first training. I wasn't that early, but I've been doing this for quite a few years. And the thing I love about the Iowa Water, it's really not looking for problems. It's really establishing baseline data. We really don't know on a lot of our streams what the quality is. And you need a starting point to figure out if it's getting worse, if it's getting better. So that's why I got involved with it. And the Iowa Water is a simple one-day workshop that you go for the basic level, and they give you all the tools. I was lucky enough that I have a friend of mine, Mike Metz, who's been on this show with you before. Hi, Mike. He's probably out there listening this morning. And so we established sites, and with Iowa Water, you can choose your own locations. If there's a stream in your neighborhood that you're concerned about because your kids are playing in it, you can choose that site. People like the Squaw Creek Group, the Alliance, they often look for people and try and spread people out so they can, you know, test a whole area to get some baseline data. And so when I got started in this, Mike Metz and I would meet the second Monday of every month. That's what we set our parameters for. And we would go bring dinner, and we'd sit along the edge of the creek and first have some sandwiches and pop and a little bit of conversation. That's a cool thing about Iowa Water. It's about spending time with friends outdoors, which is what I'm all about with my job. And then when we get in the stream and you really immerse yourself in the environment, you wade out in there and you're measuring things like the how much water there is by measuring the depth and the volume of the stream. The Iowa Water has all the pre-made forms that you use with step-by-step processes. Once we do that water volume, then we have simple chemical tests that we use. And they're just dip tests that you dip in the water, you wait a certain amount of time, and they change color. And we're measuring things like nitrates, nitrites, phosphate, dissolved oxygen, looking at chlorides in the water. I mean, chloride, that's what we put on our roads in the wintertime to keep them.
Sounds a little complicated for those of us who haven't had chemistry in school. I somehow slipped by that. I gather you're suggesting the training will prepare people to take these readings all right.
It really does. And it does sound complicated, but the kits that they give you are so The instructions are so simple. I mean, it's really, you have a vial, you open it up, and you pull out this test strip, and it's got a little cotton square on it. You dip it in the water, and it says, wait 15 seconds. And then it has a color chart, and you just slide it down until the colors match, and below it's a number. And then you write that number on your sheet. If you could tell the difference between peach and pink, you can do the water quality testing.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. I assume you have to buy your own boots, though, for going into the water.
Yeah, or just a nice pair of sandals when the water's warm. Yeah, I love that, the feel of the water around my feet. And then the part that Mike and I really enjoy, the chemical testing's fun, but the part I like is looking at the macroinvertebrates, and they give you nets and a simple sheet with pictures of all the bugs. You're looking for riffle beetles, and you're looking for dragonfly nymphs and all the different critters, snails, the left pouch snail, the right pouch snail. And it's a simple checklist. You just move your net around in the water and you look what's in there and you say, yes, I found this and I found this and I found this. Because the insects that are there, the invertebrates that are there, can tell you the quality of the water. Some of them need higher oxygen levels and better temperatures. Now, once you get going into that and you get doing that for a while, then you have a next level where it's actually more advanced, where instead of just saying this is a dragonfly, it's, okay, what species of dragonfly is it? Or and then there they're actually looking at actual numbers, where the first level is just, is it there or is it not there?
And you actually count the number of insects that you find, and that will help to determine the health or lack of health of that particular section of the stream?
Correct. Correct. I mean, just think about with people. You know, if you take a 10-mile area of Iowa, there's more people living in a 10-mile area of Iowa than probably 10-mile area of the Sahara Desert, because it can't support the people. So the more you have, obviously, the better health of that environment. There also is another level, which I am not trained in, but Mike Metz is, and that's actually where they take water samples back and culture for bacteria and things like that, looking for E. coli, fecal bacteria and stuff. And he has a background in labs, so he does
Could
that.
Could I raise that question for those who are listening and might want to volunteer? Then they may wonder, well, how safe is it for me to go into the water like this to collect this information? Is there anything they need to be concerned about?
Really not. I mean, there's protocol you can take. I mean, we always eat before we get in the water, so we don't have the water on our hands. You know, if you are concerned, a good pair of rubber boots will keep you out of the water. You know, I'm happy to say that Mike Metz and I have tested Bear Creek, where it dumps into the Skunk River. And then just last year, we started testing McFarland Park, the lake in McFarland Park, where the water comes in. And in the dock area, we do a lot of programs with kids because we were concerned. I mean, we have kids in that water doing activities. And so far, we have found that, you know, the water quality around here is decent. It's good. Could it be better? Yes. Is there anything that we went, oh, we don't want to be in that water? No, not in the stuff we have. On the flip side of that, there have been Iowa water testers who have found issues. Because of what they found, communities have been able to address that and improve the quality of water in their area.
Well, actually, this story has been told before. It's Irv Claus's story. He was testing it was in Squaw Creek, where he found near Ames, he found a lot of E. coli, and it was a broken sewer line. Mm-hmm. And the city would not have known that if it hadn't been for the testing. And he has the same kit that Mike Metz has, I guess. Not your kit. So, although he sent that away to be analyzed, it was off the charts, of course, if you've got your sewer going into your river.
Yeah. He found data that showed him that there might be a problem, and then he collected that and then sent it away to a certified lab in order to get those results.
Right. And then the city acted.
quickly.
Right. You know, the one thing I want to mention, too, when we were talking, when Pat was talking earlier about watershed and the whole Squaw Creek going into the Skunk River, going into the Mississippi River, if there's people that are having a problem with that concept, when I teach watersheds to kids, I always tell them, look at a tree. A tree is a good model of a watershed. Because your smaller streams are those little tiny branches way on the end. And then those little branches join up with bigger branches. And those bigger branches join up with even bigger branches. And those join up to the trunk. And those trunks go down to the ground. And so think about the ground as the Gulf of Mexico. That trunk is the Mississippi River. And all those branches are the Skunk River and the Des Moines River and the Ohio River that go off of the Mississippi. And we're somewhere up there towards the end of that branch in the Squaw Creek watershed.
And Ames is a little leaf on the tree somewhere.
Exactly. And Ames is that leaf, all that impermeable surface that just grabs that water and takes it right down into that onto that branch.
Susan, I think we need to tell our listeners that they're listening to KHOI Community Radio for Central Iowa, serving Story City, Ames, and surrounding areas.
Well, this has been very, very interesting. Never look at that stream that I drive by again in the same way.
No, and you really don't. Once you get into it, then you start noticing things. You know, the salt that goes on the road, you know, I never thought about it before. When my driveway was icy, I put sand and salt down. Once I started getting into this and looking at chloride issues in the water, I now just sand my driveway because I don't want that salt, you know, getting into our waterways.
Well, now let's get to what's very, very important to all of us about our water, and that's our drinking water. And for that, I'd like to go back to Pat up in Minnesota to tell us about what our aquifers are. We haven't mentioned those yet.
Sure. Basically, an aquifer is an underground rock formation that holds water, and that's where we pull the drinking water for Ames, for instance, comes from a deep aquifer. It's related to watershed management in that watersheds and even larger areas, so these aquifers have their own watershed, if you will, but that's a large regional area that fills these aquifers over a long, long period of time. And what we're seeing in many areas is that as we make that connection between our surface waters and our lands more apparent, we're losing that infiltration into the ground, and therefore we're losing that recharge, that long, slow recharge to our aquifers. So we can see that over a course of, you know, decades, we may be impacting these aquifers. Other areas where we've got shallower aquifers, we've got potential for an interaction with the surface waters and those aquifers. So these pollutants and these contaminants that build up on our land surfaces, in those cases, some of those are actually infiltrating down and getting into the groundwater. So in portions like southern Minnesota, we have issues where we've got nitrogen getting down into the groundwater and causing problems. Other areas, that groundwater management and surface water management gets interrelated in that we are punching so many wells into these shallow groundwater areas that we're actually seeing a decrease in our surface water elevations. So we've got a handful of lakes up here in the Twin Cities area that are experiencing this phenomenon where they're basically being drained from below because of these high pumping rates out of the aquifers.
Right now, in the west of the U.S., some of these great aquifers are actually, as you were suggesting, being depleted, and one wonders where these larger populations are going to get their water in the future.
Correct. You know, and that brings up another point that I should have mentioned earlier is that, you know, downstream, if you think, go back to your tree example, as we get further downstream and further down that tree, there are communities that pull their drinking water out of that, you know, out of the Mississippi and out of the other rivers. So, you know, Ames isn't pulling drinking water out of the squaw or the skunk, but as you get further downstream, communities are pulling their drinking water out of that. So that's, you know, that becomes a what we do in our landscape is having a direct effect on those folks.
Now, I have a great quote from Penny that I'd like to play just to address this exactly, and then we'll get into some of what you're doing up in Minnesota.
So the Squaw Creek watershed is at the headwaters of the Skunk River watershed. So it's going to deposit all of its water into the Skunk River. And, of course, the Skunk is a fairly large river, and it's going to go ahead. It's going to proceed on down south as it flows. So, which is something interesting to think about because, so here we are at the headwaters, and if our water's not clean when it leaves the Squaw Creek watershed, that means then the next sub-watershed folks might have to clean it up, and if they don't clean theirs, then, you know, you're sort of doubling all the time the problems that you might be sending on down the river. And I was talking to Pat Conrad from EOR, and it struck me sort of interesting that in Minnesota, I think people finally came to understand that it was their responsibility to make sure that the water that was part of the landscape that they owned was clean before it left their property. And that's a really important idea to kind of ponder.
Well, thank you. And Pat, what are you doing in Minnesota to get this sense of responsibility?
I guess before I address that, I would just like to add what Penny mentioned about everybody kind of being downstream of, you know, everybody else is upstream. But, you know, when we look at the issues that are occurring down in the Gulf of Mexico with the dead zone that's affecting so many people down there, we in the Squaw Creek watershed are the uppermost source of those nutrients that are causing that problem. So again, it's important to manage everything as far upstream as we can. As far as the attitude in Minnesota, I always refer to it as the demand for water quality is much higher up in Minnesota, largely because we have so many lakes, I think. You know, we have so many lakes and we have so many streams, and the expectation is that we can use those lakes and streams for whatever we want. We should be able to drink those streams and lakes, people feel. People always have this romantic notion of the past when they were kids and how clean that water was. So there's a strong demand for having clean water, and people have expressed this in terms of a willingness to even pay and increase their taxes so that money can be, pots of money can be built up so that people can do projects and get water quality improvements.
Do you think we have the same attitude in Iowa, would you guess?
Pardon me?
Do you think we have that same attitude in Iowa?
You know, I haven't seen it quite as much as far as the real connection between our water resources as a recreational asset in Iowa. You know, we have there are a lot of streams, but I don't feel that there's that same, you know, there's not a trout fisheries, there's not a real active recreation. When we have nice clean waters, then I think people, you know, flock to those kind of resources. But as we get further up into the watersheds and these streams get smaller and smaller, I think they are looked at more as a conveyance of agricultural drainage or of urban drainage, not as much of a recreational asset that they could be looked at.
Well, thank you very much. I have a question for you, though, from Penny that I want to ask. She asked you, how many animals are there in the Squaw Creek watershed?
Well, okay, so what we've begun to do, and this kind of gets back to a review of the monitoring information that's been collected, we've found elevated levels of E. coli within the stream, well above Iowa standards. And so what we do as part of our assessment work of the watershed, we try to develop estimates of the different types of animals that are producing E. coli. And so we can really kind of focus on where do we want to start first, and what kind of animal populations do we want to look at. So we look at human populations, so we look at what comes out of the various septic systems and wastewater treatment facilities. We look at wildlife estimates. We look at even pet estimates to try to get a handle on who's the biggest, you know, who's the biggest source. And then we look at that production and how likely is it that that's getting into the stream. So just the fact that we have, you know, 300,000 turkeys in the, you know, Hamilton County portion of the watershed, that doesn't necessarily mean that all of that manure and E. coli is available and getting down into the stream. So we look at all these population estimates, and then we have to assess how that manure is being spread on the fields and how is that available for getting down into the stream. There are nutrient management regulations that these large producers are under that they're following, but there's always that chance that material is able to wash down into the stream. It's just by nature. But we do have some very, very large animal counts within the watershed, particularly hogs and turkey, which I'm sure you guys are aware of.
Well, thank you. That's maybe a little grim note.
Sombering thought, but I like the fact that you point out that the fact that we have these large concentrations of animals doesn't necessarily mean that all of that is going to get into the water system.
No. Yeah, one thing I'd like to say, you know, when I teach watershed and water quality issues to students, I talk about, you know, pollution is anything where it doesn't belong. Your manure is a valuable fertilizer if it's applied appropriately. And that's the whole idea of this is, I mean, one of our largest pollutions in water is soil. But without our soil, Iowa wouldn't be the great farming state that it is. What we need to do is find measures to keep the stuff where it's supposed to be. We are a fertilizer, pesticide-based, you know, state. That's what helps us grow our food, but we need to use it wisely and apply it wisely so it stays where it's supposed to be. It stays on our soil. I mean, there's only so many inches of good topsoil. If it's gone, Iowa's not going to be the farming state that it is. So it's keeping everything where it's supposed to be, using it wisely, and keeping it out of the rivers is really what the focus when I talk this issue with students.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thanks to both of you. Thanks to Jerry Keyes and to Pat Conrad. And we need to move on to our next section.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. It was very interesting.
Oh, it was a pleasure being with you guys this morning.
I always love being here. Hope to be back.
Thanks, Jerry. So just a few seconds of Peter Otrusko's Monkey in a Dog Cart before we go into NAMI, okay?
I'm Kay Potok, and I'm here with Willow McLaughlin, who's the president of the board of NAMI, which stands for National Alliance of Mental Illness, NAMI Central Iowa, I should say.
Right.
Welcome, Willow. I'm so glad you could come. Well, I've already interviewed Deb Niehoff, who's the executive director of NAMI, and I was wondering how your job is different from hers.
Well, Deb is executive director of all of NAMI Central Iowa. Mm-hmm. My job as the president of the board is to preside over the board. So her job is a lot harder than mine.
But boards can be pretty, pretty difficult things to preside over.
They can be. We're very lucky in that our board members are all very agreeable and respectful towards each other. So they make my job very easy.
Oh, well, that's good. Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in NAMI?
Well, gosh, years ago, I got a hold of Deb and let her know that I have had a background in art therapy and I wanted to do it. And she just so happened that she had been at a conference where it came up that was a good thing to do. So Deb and I talked and decided that that'd be a great match. And I want to say that was 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I started leading a monthly art therapy group. Maybe a year after I had been doing that, they asked me to join the board, and then I became president this past July.
Oh, so it's quite a recent thing for you.
Yeah, just since July.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. But you're liking it so far.
I do. I love it. I think I want to say I've been doing the art therapy for 4 or 5 years now. And every month I just love going there. They're such a great group and they're always, dare I say, excited to do my harebrained activities. And I hardly ever even get complaints, maybe a grumble here and there. But for the most part, people are on board with trying new things and it's really fun.
Uh-huh. Well, I remember seeing some art on the wall there of people, portraits, mm-hmm. self-portraits,
right.
with the face divided, good mood and bad mood.
Yep, yep.
You know, that's the right way. Was that one of your ideas?
It wasn't one of my ideas. We have another gal that does an art activity once a month,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of her classes, but those are really neat.
Uh-huh, they
one are. Half of the face, I believe, it's on a good day, and then the other half was on a bad day.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said you had a background in art therapy. Is that your career or your, what you might say, daytime job? Or?
It's not even close. But, but it is something that I love to do, and I'm really happy to have that outlet that I have with NAMI to do it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So this is it's sort of a volunteer thing completely?
Completely, yep.
Ah, even the training to do it, did that as a volunteer?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
And I used to work in the mental health field for my day job, and I used it then.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't for a couple of years.
I see. Mm-hmm. I see. Can I ask what your day job is?
Sure. I work for our family company. It's a seed corn company in Ellsworth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I do marketing there.
Oh, okay. So that's completely different.
Completely different.
Completely different.
Except for the fact that I work with my husband. And so there's a lot of mental health exercises that I have to use to get through a day with my husband.
Well, psychologically skilled, maybe. Yes. Would you like to tell us about some of the exercises you've done in art therapy?
Yeah, that'd be great. Just today, actually, I just came from an art therapy session, and we had the group. There's probably 8 to 10 folks there, and we all had a couple puzzle pieces that they decorated however they wanted.
Like jigsaw puzzle, you mean?
Yeah, yep, uh-huh. yep. Some people use Sharpie, some people collaged from magazine cutouts, some people painted these random pieces, and then in the end we put them all together to see a finished piece of art, and it was really cool. At first when we started putting it together, it was just these random, everyone looked different, but then once we got it all done, it looked like a finished piece of art with the intent.
So with the intent of what exactly?
That's how we wanted it to look.
Oh.
Yeah. It turned out really cool. Now,
did you put any piece, this sounds a bit like, patchwork quilt sewing. Did you put any, blank blocks in, as it were, too?
No. Nope. Everything had a design on it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds very interesting. Yeah. Now, is there any way to frame something like that, or would that be just doing it is the point?
Well, just doing it is the point. I always tell our folks that, when I give them the directive, what we're going to do that day, don't think about what you want it to look like in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all about the journey to get there.
Right.
It's all about the process and the feelings behind it, the emotion behind the artwork. Not necessarily that you made something beautiful, but that you had some kind of a emotional connection to it while you were doing it.
Right. So it's the process,
it's
not
the
product.
Yep. But however, we always end up making really cool stuff.
Uh-huh.
I think because it's so emotionally charged, you have this connection to it. Whether or not it looks like you wanted it to, it always ends up being really meaningful.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Have you got another one you could tell us about?
Another activity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me think back. What do we do? Okay, one of the activities that is always a big hit is what I call a visual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we have people get in a small group, say 2 or 3 people, and there's no talking, which is really hard for this group to do, but we try to have no talking, and they pass a paper back and forth. And you add a no words drawing, but just a drawing to that paper, pass it to your partner, then they add to it and pass it back and forth. And between the two of you, you complete one piece of art.
So, say you've just passed it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not allowed to speak, but I look at it and I respond
exactly
to what I see there.
Yep, you have a kind of conversation through the artwork.
Uh-huh.
And so, a lot of times people kind of stay in their own frame of mind and try to finish what they had in mind for the drawing. Sometimes they do a good job of collaborating back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting to see where it ends up.
That sounds like a fun kind of thing to do at a party or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that could be a good party.
I mean, you know, the bigger group maybe or something.
Yep. And in the at the end of every session, we always make sure to name our piece of art. And that just helps kind of make that another emotional connection to it, as well as reminding you where you were at when you made it. And so that the visual conversation is a fun one to name, because you have to collaborate, and you know that's where you really start to talk about what you were doing there, what you were thinking when you drew that piece.
Right. People are allowed to talk about it when they've done.
Yeah, when they're all done, yep.
Yes, okay, okay. And how long would it take to produce the art and then to talk about it? The two, I'm interested in the length of time for each activity.
You know, our sessions are an hour, and usually we spend about the first 45 minutes doing the actual art, and then the last 15 or so we share. If you want to, you can share what you've done and talk about it, tell the title, and just tell how you got to that point. We do that. That's how we do it every session.
I see. Well, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
How many people about come to each of these art therapy sessions?
We have anywhere from 5 to 15 people. You know, everything depends on if, you know, the weather, transportation, other things going on. But we kind of have a core group of people that have been doing it for a long time.
So they obviously enjoy it a lot. Now, you've got a fundraiser coming up soon in March. A trivia night.
Right.
Would you like to tell us about that?
Yeah, on March 8th at the Boys and Girls Club, we're going to have a trivia night. So this is our second trivia night fundraiser that we're going to have coming up on March 8th at the Boys and Girls Club. And so if you want to get together with a team and come and compete against the other teams for, it's kind of random knowledge.
Like general knowledge kind of stuff.
Yep, some general knowledge, some stuff that's off the wall. It's really fun, though. We also had a dessert auction at our last one. And I tell you, I was 7 months pregnant with twins at our last one, so that was the highlight for me.
That was a year ago, was it?
Almost, yeah, almost a year ago. So it's a really fun night.
Okay. And what time will this be?
I don't think that's set yet.
Okay, it's not set.
No.
But if they look on your website, they could be up to date on that.
At this point.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to the trivia night, and thank you so much for coming to talk to us today about NAMI CI.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kay Potok, and I've been talking to Willow McLaughlin, who's the president of the board of NAMI CI, which is the National Alliance for Mental Illness of Central Iowa. Willow also leads an art therapy group at NAMI CI's Wellness Center, which is at 410 Douglas Avenue in downtown Ames. The Trivia Night fundraiser for NAMI will be held on March the 8th at the Boys and Girls Club of Story County, which is at 210 South 5th Street, Ames. Keep an eye on the NAMI CI website for details of Trivia Night. The website is namiofci.org. That's namiofci.org. This has been a segment of KHOI Radio's Community Service Appreciation Program.
This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Our program today was about the Squaw Creek Watershed Authority and its plans. Our reporter, Kay Potok, talked on the community organization that we're focusing on this month, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, or NAMI.
We have been speaking with Jerry Keyes of Story County Conservation Board, Pat Conrad of EOR, Water Ecology Community in Oakdale, Minnesota, Penny Brown Huber, Director of Prairie Rivers of Iowa, and Willow McLaughlin of NAMI. Reporter for today was Kay Potok.
Your hosts were Susan Franson and Tom Beal. Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison and Becca Brown. Music you heard was Monkey on a Wagon by Peter Ostrusko from his CD Blue Mesa.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information, as well as other resources mentioned on our shows. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses. We'd appreciate your feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and
see you again on the radio.